from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
If you wonder, wrote Robert Parry, how the world could stumble into World War III, much as it did into World War I a century ago, all you need to do is look at the madness that has enveloped virtually the entire US political media structure over Ukraine, where a false narrative of white hats versus black hats took hold early and has proved impervious to facts or reason.
That was the world-renowned war correspondent and documentary filmmaker John Pilger discussing, as he sees it, the massive media propaganda effort to drum up support for war with Russia, an effort he likened to the build-up to the 2003 Iraq War. He was addressing the Logan Symposium in London last December 5th.
In 2003, I filmed an interview in Washington with Chuck Lewis, the distinguished journalist who's taking part in this conference. We discussed the invasion of Iraq a few months earlier. I asked him, what if the freest media in the world had seriously challenged George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and investigated their claims instead of channeling what turned out to be crude propaganda? He replied that if we journalists had done our job, and I quote, there's a very, very good chance we would have not gone to war in Iraq, unquote. That's a shocking statement, and one that's supported by other famous journalists to whom I put the same question. Dan Rather, formerly of CBS, gave me the same answer, more or less. David Rose of The Observer gave me pretty well the same answer. Senior journalists and producers in the BBC who wish to remain anonymous gave me the same answer. In other words, had journalists done their job, had they questioned and investigated the propaganda instead of amplifying it, hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children might be alive today, and millions might not have fled their homes, the sectarian war between Sunni and Shia might not have ignited, and the infamous Islamic State might not now exist.
Nevertheless, it's hard to dispute Pilger's assertion that the failures of the media which led to the Iraq War not only continue, but have actually grown worse. One case of obvious media failure and or outright malfeasance, which we reported earlier, is that of a video report Wednesday on the Guardian newspaper's website, which placed the blame for a bombing attack on a food pantry in the East on local defense forces. The video was altered in the editing room to shift the blame away from the actual perpetrators of the attack, Kiev's military. That report includes selected parts of the original video featured under an English-language voiceover. This is the portion from the Guardian website that attributes the bombing to the forces of the breakaway republics in eastern Ukraine.
The building had been hit by rocket fire from pro-Russian rebels, leaving shattered windows and debris everywhere.
That entire report, with the exception of a random and unrelated shot of a tank added towards the end, was a heavily edited version of the original video and audio of the actual bombing captured by American journalist Patrick Lancaster, who's been in East Ukraine since fighting began there last year. Lancaster's video posted at YouTube is titled Rocket Attack, Community Soup Kitchen in LNR-controlled Prvomaisk Hit by Ukraine Grad Rockets, closed quote. Also left on the editing room floor were the parts of the video which recorded comments from the victims of the attack condemning Kiev's President Pyotr Poroshenko for the bombing. That report at the Guardian website appears identical to one produced by the UK media outlet ITN News at its ODN website. As the fighting continued Wednesday, peace talks in Minsk were concluded among the so-called Normandy Four, France's President François Hollande, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko, and Russia's President Vladimir Putin. This was President Putin at the conclusion of the 14-hour marathon session early Thursday.
We had to deal with the circumstances we've had, and I think we've been able to reach a lot of things. The first thing is the ceasefire. starting on the 15th of February at midnight. The next thing that I believe is very important is the withdrawal of heavy weapons for Ukrainian troops. As of today, the line that they have as of today, the Ukrainian troops, and the withdrawal of Donbas militias from this line that was pinpointed in the agreement we signed last year. Now, there is also the political settlement. The first thing is a constitutional reform that should take into consideration the legitimate rights of people who live in Donbas. Next, what follows is border issues, which should be coordinated with the Donbas militias, as well as humanitarian affairs and the implementation of the earlier adopted law on a special status of Donetsk and Luhansk. And finally, there is a whole range of economic and humanitarian issues. We hope that all the parties will exercise restraint before there is an entire total ceasefire. However, the original problem was that the representatives of the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics maintain that as a response to the aggressive action by the Kyiv authorities, they did not only hold back their attacks, but they even launched an offensive and they encircled a group of 6,000 to 8,000 troops. They believe, they hope that those troops will lay down their arms and stop resistance. But yet, we call on all the parties to exercise restraint, to prevent further bloodshed, and do the utmost in order to make sure that the withdrawal of troops and heavy weapons goes well as planned.
And we will continue to follow this as it develops. As we reported Wednesday, U.S. troops are apparently headed back to Iraq and to Syria. President Barack Obama sent Congress a proposed war powers resolution to authorize military force. This was the president making the announcement Wednesday.
Good afternoon. Today, as part of an international coalition of some 60 nations, including Arab countries, our men and women in uniform continue to fight against ISIL in Iraq and in Syria. More than 2,000 coalition airstrikes have pounded these terrorists. We're disrupting their command and control and supply lines, making it harder for them to move. We're destroying their fighting positions, their tanks, their vehicles, their barracks, their training camps, and the oil and gas facilities and infrastructure that fund their operations. We're taking out their commanders, their fighters, and their leaders. In Iraq, local forces have largely held the line and in some places have pushed ISIL back. In Syria, ISIL failed in its major push to take the town of Kobani, losing countless fighters in the process, fighters who will never again threaten innocent civilians. And we've seen reports of sinking morale among ISIL fighters as they realize the futility of their cause. Now, make no mistake, this is a difficult mission, and it will remain difficult for some time. It's going to take time to dislodge these terrorists, especially from urban areas. But our coalition is on the offensive. ISIL is on the defensive, and ISIL is going to lose. Its barbaric murders of so many people, including American hostages, are a desperate and revolting attempt to strike fear in the hearts of people it can never possibly win over by its ideas or its ideology, because it offers nothing but misery and death and destruction. And with vile groups like this, there is only one option. With our allies and partners, we are going to degrade and ultimately destroy this terrorist group. And when I announced our strategy against ISIL in September, I said that we are strongest as a nation when the President and Congress work together. Today, my administration submitted a draft resolution to Congress to authorize the use of force against ISIL. I want to be very clear about what it does and what it does not do. This resolution reflects our core objective to destroy ISIL. It supports the comprehensive strategy that we've been pursuing with our allies and our partners. A systemic and sustained campaign of airstrikes against ISIL in Iraq and Syria, support and training for local forces on the ground, including the moderate Syrian opposition, preventing ISIL attacks in the region and beyond, including by foreign terrorist fighters who try to threaten our countries, regional and international support for an inclusive Iraqi government that unites the Iraqi people and strengthens Iraqi forces against ISIL, humanitarian assistance for the innocent civilians of Iraq and Syria who are suffering so terribly under ISIL's reign of horror. I want to thank Vice President Biden, Secretaries Kerry and Hagel, and General Marty Dempsey for their leadership in advancing our strategy. Even as we meet this challenge in Iraq and Syria, we all agree that one of our weapons against terrorists like ISIL, a critical part of our strategy, is the values we live here at home. One of the best antidotes to the hateful ideologies that try to recruit and radicalize people to violent extremism is our own example as diverse and tolerant societies that welcome the contributions of all people, including people of all faiths. The resolution we've submitted today does not call for the deployment of U.S. ground combat forces to Iraq or Syria. It is not the authorization of another ground war, like Afghanistan or Iraq. The 2,600 American troops in Iraq today largely serve on bases. And yes, they face the risks that come with service in any dangerous environment, but they do not have a combat mission. They are focused on training Iraqi forces, including Kurdish forces. As I've said before, I'm convinced that the United States should not get dragged back into another prolonged ground war in the Middle East. That's not in our national security interest, and it's not necessary for us to defeat ISIL. Local forces on the ground who know their countries best are best positioned to take the ground fight to ISIL, and that's what they're doing. At the same time, this resolution strikes the necessary balance by giving us the flexibility we need for unforeseen circumstances. For example, if we had actionable intelligence about a gathering of ISIL leaders, and our partners didn't have the capacity to get them, I would be prepared to order our special forces to take action, because I will not allow these terrorists to have a safe haven. So we need flexibility, but we also have to be careful and deliberate. And there's no heavier decision than asking our men and women in uniform to risk their lives on our behalf. As Commander-in-Chief, I will only send our troops into harm's way when it is absolutely necessary for our national security. Finally, this resolution repeals the 2002 authorization of force for the invasion of Iraq and limits this new authorization to 3 years. I do not believe America's interests are served by endless war or by remaining on a perpetual war footing. As a nation, we need to ask the difficult and necessary questions about when, why, and how we use military force. After all, it is our troops who bear the costs of our decisions, and we owe them a clear strategy and the support they need to get the job done. So this resolution will give our armed forces and our coalition the continuity we need for the next 3 years. It is not a timetable. It is not announcing that the mission is completed at any given period. What it is saying is that Congress should revisit the issue at the beginning of the next president's term. It's conceivable that the mission is completed earlier. It's conceivable that after deliberation, debate, and evaluation, that there are additional tasks to be carried out in this area. And the people's representatives, with a new president, should be able to have that discussion. In closing, I want to say that in crafting this resolution, we have consulted with and listened to both Republicans and Democrats in Congress. We made a sincere effort to address difficult issues that we've discussed together. In the days and weeks ahead, we'll continue to work closely with leaders and members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. I believe this resolution can grow even stronger with the thoughtful and dignified debate that this moment demands. I'm optimistic that it can win strong bipartisan support and that we can show our troops and the world that Americans are united in this mission. Now, today, our men and women in uniform continue the fight against ISIL, and we salute them for their courageous service. We pray for their safety. We stand with their families who miss them and who are sacrificing here at home. But know this, our coalition is strong, our cause is just, and our mission will succeed. And long after the terrorists we face today are destroyed and forgotten, America will continue to stand free and tall and strong. May God bless our troops, and may God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much, everybody.
President Obama's intent to take the military actions in Iraq and Syria was greeted with some skepticism in Baghdad. Both Iraq's foreign minister and a senior member of the Iraqi parliament challenged President Obama's claims, with Foreign Minister Ibrahim Jafari saying Iraq has never asked for foreign troops on the ground in his country, and the head of the Iraqi parliament's Defense and Security Committee accusing the U.S. and its allies of providing support to ISIL in the north of the country. We have this report from Press TV.
The Iraqi Parliament's Security and Defense Committee, Hakim al-Zamali, has accused the U.S. of violating Iraq's sovereignty and international law and prolonging the conflict with ISIL.
Coalition aircraft are providing airdrops to the ISIL militants. We have also documented information that coalition aircraft are constantly making landings in airports located in regions under ISIL control.
Al-Zamali also verified the presence of documents which prove that the so-called U.S.-led coalition has indeed given several airdrops to ISIL's aid.
We're calling on the Iraqi government to take a clear and firm stance against these actions. We would also like to ask the Ministry of Defense and our Air Force to monitor these aircraft and even to target them if they do provide assistance to the ISIL.
U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Stuart Jones, has denied such accusations, saying they are aimed at driving a wedge between the U.S.-led coalition and Baghdad. Analysts, however, argue that the U.S.'s unwillingness to cooperate with regional heavyweights who are known to be opposed to ISIL proves that Washington is not serious about eradicating the terror group.
Washington has yet to sit at the negotiating table with regional countries which are known for their anti-ISIL stance and can wade in on the crisis. But the U.S. is allied with Israel, Saudi Arabia, and others that backed ISIL. This proves that Washington is pursuing its own interests here and is not bent on defeating ISIL.
The head of the Iraqi Parliament's Security and Defense Committee also stressed that such acts as providing aid for ISIL threaten Iraq's security and put the nation's armed forces in harm's way. In recent months, U.S. aid, including weapons, have made their way into ISIL's hands in both Iraq and Syria. In addition to the U.S.'s unwillingness to cooperate with regional countries in the fight against ISIL, such incidents have cast doubt over the claims that the so-called U.S.-led coalition is actually aimed at fighting ISIL. Altaf Ahmad, Press TV, Erbil.
President Obama's request on Wednesday for authority to use military force came a day before a U.N. Security Council resolution was passed unanimously that would dry up resources not only for ISIL and al-Nusra Front, but all terrorist groups operating in Syria and Iraq, including the so-called moderate opposition fighters that are backed by the United States. On Thursday, the Council unanimously adopted Resolution 2199, which bans individuals and entities from the sale of oil and payment of ransom to ISIL and al-Qaeda affiliates. It also prohibits any trafficking in antiquities with those parties. Iraq's permanent representative to the United Nations, Mohammed Ali al-Hakim, spoke to the press after the Security Council met.
In English, in briefing, we are extremely pleased, very pleased, for the adoption by the Security Council to Resolution 2199 today. This resolution is a very, very important resolution for Iraq and Syria. For Iraq, I'll speak on the Iraqi side. This is a resolution that tried to squeeze, suppress, and eliminate the financial support for terrorism, specifically for Daesh, as well as Jabhat al-Nusra, and all of the people who they are dealing with in transporting oil, smuggling oil and gas from both Iraq and Syria, as well as antiquities and cultural material. This is really, for us, is very important. Iraq worked with Russia, United States, and the United Kingdom, as well as China, and we thank them for their effort. This is a resolution that's been in work for the past 4 months or more, a little bit, and it's a really a complementary resolution to 2170. This resolution has many aspects. Please read it carefully because it is very important. It's under Chapter 7, and it's important for all of the regional countries to deal with this. This is to eliminate, to suppress the financial support for the terrorists, which is specifically Daesh and al-Nusra. For Iraq, why this is important? Because terrorists are smuggling oil and gas, they are smuggling antiquities, they are smuggling cultural materials from Mosul, from Nineveh, from the area that they are occupying right now, and we are trying to get help from the international community under Chapter 7. And there is also a follow-up in this particular resolution. The follow-up is very clear. Every 120 days, there will be a report to the Security Council on the activities by these countries. So for us, this is a Chapter 7 resolution with a follow-up to the Security Council. So for Iraq, we are very much appreciated to appreciate the work of China, work of Russia, United States, and United Kingdom, and then also we thank the support of the entire Security Council members for this resolution.
The adoption of Resolution 2199 Thursday appeared to vindicate remarks made by Syria's permanent representative to the UN last summer. On August 15, 2014, the Council adopted Resolution 2170, condemning gross, widespread abuse of human rights by extremist groups in Iraq and Syria by ISIL and al-Nusra Front. The resolution named individuals subject to travel restrictions, asset freezes, and other measures targeting al-Qaeda affiliates, called on member states to take national measures to prevent fighters from traveling from their soil to join the groups, and expressed readiness to consider adding to sanctions lists those parties facilitating the recruitment and travel of foreign fighters. Following the adoption of the August resolution, Syria's permanent representative, Bashar Ja'afari, spoke with Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli. The Syrian ambassador pointed out that his country had been fighting terrorist groups for the 3 years prior to August, while others in the regime and some on the Security Council had been supporting those groups. He also raised the very questions that Thursday's resolution now appears to address. On Thursday, following the remarks of his Iraqi colleague, Ambassador Ja'afari spoke to the press at the UN in New York about the passage of Thursday's resolution.
Dear colleague, Ambassador of Iraq, I would like to add the following. After 4 years of serious and deep crisis that has prevailed in the area, namely speaking, Syria and Iraq, and to a lesser degree, other countries in the area, our joint efforts bear fruits. Through the adoption by the Security Council a little while ago of its Resolution 2199. This resolution is the most comprehensive resolution aiming at combating terrorism, in particular the terrorism perpetrated by the gangs of Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra, al-Nusra Front in English. So we are very pleased to see that the Council has moved finally in the right direction towards establishing and setting a wider framework to combating terrorism and to guaranteeing a full commitment of all member states towards achieving this very important goal. It's very important for Syria and Iraq because we are the main victims of this kind of blind terrorism sponsored by foreign powers and foreign intelligence. intelligence services. As we said many times in our remarks, the terrorists who spread all over the area, namely speaking in Syria and Iraq, did not come to Syria and Iraq through parachutes. They come through common borders with neighbors of Syria and Iraq. We all know nowadays that these terrorists, in their majority, crossed our borders coming from Turkey and Jordan. It's really unfortunate that Jordan, which is a member of the Security Council, has allowed for years a policy of training, sponsoring, and sending terrorists through their common border with Syria to inside Syria. So the Jordanian authorities saw finally the terrorism in Raqqa and Mosul in Iraq, but they did not see the terrorism coming through their own borders inside Syria and Iraq. Syria welcomes the adoption of the Security Council Resolution 2199, as Iraq did, and highly appreciates the initiative of the Russian Federations and the Chinese Chinese delegation in their efforts in this regard. This resolution complements important aspects that have not been sufficiently focused on in the previous Security Council resolutions concerning combating terrorism, including Security Council resolutions 2170 and 2178. Resolution 2199 imposes strong and clear commitments on all the states supporting terrorism in both Syria and Iraq, and those commitments are related specifically to oil trade, gas trade, trafficking in cultural heritage items, in addition to preventing terrorist organizations from acquiring manpads. This is why we said this is the widest and the most comprehensive resolution adopted by the Security Council on the issue of combating terrorism. Still, the main point is to transform the nice words into deeds, as we say. We have so far in our arsenal three resolutions on combating terrorism. Three of them are adopted under Chapter 7. Still, Turkey is allowing the terrorists to cross Syrian-Turkish border and to perpetrate terrorist acts in Syria. I'm here referring specifically to Daesh, ISIL, and Al-Nusra Front. Turkey is not alone with this regard. Israel is helping the terrorists in the Golan, as you know. The same kind of terrorists, Al-Nusra Front. The same kind of terrorists are coming also from Jordan, where they are trained by the joint room of operation, as joint command room of military operation, as they call it in Jordan, where the Mossad, the Israelis, the Turkish, the Saudi, the Qataris, and the Americans and the French are supervising this kind of camps of training of terrorists. They call them moderate terrorists, but the Security Council has specifically stated right now that there is no moderate terrorist and extremist terrorist. Here the resolution speaks about combating terrorism, all kind of terrorism perpetrated by either Daesh or Al-Nusra Front or any other terrorist organizations. It is strange that some do not yet see that the elephant in the room by them insisting not to point the finger to the right direction. We have heard one of the permanent representatives saying something very strange with this regard, equating Daesh to the Syrian government, for instance. The terrorism that is hitting Syria and other states did not come from a vacuum and did not happen out of a sudden.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.